You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha. This is Lecture 5, entitled Life and the Mysteries. I have often mentioned Hermann Grimm in connection with the history of spiritual events. I would like to associate with the subject before us today a very distinctive, I might say instinctive, remark he made about the necessary course of human mentality at the present time, though he was unable to transform this instinctive feeling into knowledge. In Grimm we find a kind of antagonism toward the whole way of regarding history. He had a feeling, which was correct, that the present way of regarding history came about unconsciously, and therefore, again, instinctively, because the Christ event had, in the course of evolution, been excluded therefrom. At least it had not been thought necessary to give it a place in the first line of importance in human evolution. It was Grimm's desire that history should be studied so that the Christ should be represented as the most important factor in the whole course of human progress, and that it should be clearly demonstrated how immensely important the impulse was that entered human evolution through the mystery of Golgotha. Because of Hermann Grimm's instinctive perception of what might be called Goethe's world outlook, and because through his incapacity to see into the spiritual world, this remained only instinctive, he was unable to give clear expression to it. It may seem paradoxical to say that history has regarded it as its main business to expunge the event of Jesus Christ from history, yet this is a fact. Many persons would do anything to prevent the deeper meaning of the Christ event from finding a place in the record of events affecting humanity. Through this instinctive feeling, which dwelt with such force in many souls, great darkness lay over the centuries immediately following the mystery of Golgotha. Not that people did not try to understand it, even historically, but they introduced into their conception of it things that had occurred both in the centuries before and after, not distinguishing with sufficient care the things that happened before from those that happened at the time of the mystery of Golgotha itself. When we consider how dependent our age is on authority, as regards its beliefs, we can estimate how successful history has been in allowing so little to emerge throughout the centuries of what really did affect the evolution of mankind. When a personality such as Goethe appears, an example of whose method of regarding nature I gave in the last lecture, a method which led him directly to a view of the world in which nature and morality are one, the attempt is made, whenever possible, to weaken and cripple the very point which, if grasped aright, would lead men to a spiritually scientific point of view both grand and reverential. I have shown how ordinary botany did not satisfy Goethe. He desired a spiritualized botany, and with its help he arrived at finding the spirit as it is revealed in the plant kingdom. He found that spirit to which, in its present form, the vegetable kingdom cannot attain, because it is unable to carry to full completion the predispositions with which it had originally been endowed. Goethe tried to see more deeply into these predispositions, and also into those of the mineral kingdom than is possible for ordinary sense perception. It was, therefore, most inopportune for him that the opinions of Haller should have come to the fore in his day, which opinions he summed up beautifully in the following words. I'm going to try the German. Quote, ins Innere der Natur dringt kein erschaffener Geist, glückselig, wem sie nur die äußere Schale weist. To which close quote, to which Goethe replied, quote, das hör ich nun seit 60 Jahren wiederholen und fluche darauf, aber verstohlen. Natur hat weder Kern noch Schale, alles ist sie mit einem Male, dich prüfe die nur allermeist, ob du selbst Kern oder Schale seist. Close quote, footnote. First quote was, to the inwardness of nature, no creative spirit penetrates. Fortunate are those who are only aware of her outer sheath. Close quote. To which Goethe replied, quote, I have heard this now for 60 years, and curse the words, but still in vain. Nature has neither sheath nor kernel, all in it is one. At very most thou dost but prove, if thou thyself be either sheath or kernel. Close quote. Goethe thus opposed Haller's point of view with all his might. Why? Because behind his instinctive knowledge, Goethe was possessed of a vast spiritual background, which the men of the 19th century had tried hard to bury beneath a heap of debris. How pleased such men were with the words of Schopenhauer, quote, the world is my conception, close quote, or again, quote, without the human eye, no color, no light exists, close quote. Goethe contradicts this most emphatically. It is true that without the eye no light is perceptible. But Goethe says, quote, there would be no eye without light, for the light has formed the eye, in order to perceive the light, close quote. As was indicated in the last lecture, the plant kingdom was really intended to bring forth its own kind, without fructification, by metamorphosis. Goethe had an inkling of this. Therefore he was delighted with Schelver's theory, and he had the courage to moralize over them, for this required courage. He held that the vegetable kingdom existed once in a different sphere to that in which it is at present, a sphere in which metamorphosis could be carried on. Its decline to the sphere in which it now is was caused by a great event, the fall of humanity to a lower sphere through having succumbed to the Luciferian temptation. The powers that were active in plant creation at the time they were able to carry out complete metamorphosis, that is, when their offspring simply grew out of them and the alternative method of reproduction by fructification had not arisen, have become spiritual and dwell in the surroundings of the earth. These are the powers that are the cause of man having received sense organs, such as he has at present. The words of Lucifer, quote, your eyes shall be opened, close quote, meant, quote, ye shall be placed, ye men, in another sphere, close quote. The action of light was actually such that in the sense employed by Goethe, it was able to open men's eyes. All the same, this, in quotes, opening of eyes was in another sense the closing of them, for because the eyes and the other senses of men were opened to the outer world, the spirit which dwelt in that world could not penetrate into them. The eyes of men were closed to the manifestations of the spirit. Thus arose that strange way of regarding things, which especially in the 19th century went to such ill-regulated lengths. The extraordinary, I might say, sinister teaching arose that man can behold only that which surrounds him in the external world, a teaching that in the field of natural science is simply harmful, but in the field of art, if it takes hold of the artist and he does not struggle against it, kills his artistic fancy. The strange secret governing our human evolution is this, that when a man turns from an outlook such as Goethe's and accepts Haller's, he can regard history before the mystery of Golgotha, so that he overlooks the true significance of that event. And he can also regard history after the mystery of Golgotha, so that he again misses its true significance. This may at first sound paradoxical, nevertheless it is true. It is true that when one holds the opposite view to that of Goethe, and considers the course of history from that viewpoint, pre-Christian times and events at the beginning of our era are seen at most as events. But the whole force, the mighty impulse of the mystery of Golgotha is missed. Into such a view of history, most certainly no creative spirit enters. Such people do not notice that while history unfolds its regular course up to the time to which I refer, something then intervenes, showing that a decisive turning point has been reached, the greatest turning point indeed within the whole human evolution. Again, if we turn to post-Christian history, we find how this also is influenced by the after-effects of this great turning point. Hence, an instinctive feeling arose of the need to conjure away Goethe's point of view from modern thought. People are sometimes trapped by such instinctive desires. I lay no moral blame on anyone, for the answer is simple. Such people mean well. We have but to remember the words Shakespeare puts in the mouth of Antonius, quote, "They are all honorable men," close quote. Granted, this is not, however, a case of a man holding this or that opinion. What really matters is what comes of them and what influence they have on human evolution. In this connection, it is well to call attention to the fact that behind the words of the Baptist, quote, "Repent, change the attitude of your minds," close quote, lies something extraordinarily profound. This cry is not only connected with what spiritual science can deduce from the course of human evolution, but also with what can be observed historically, if people do but desire to make Goethe's point of view a living reality. It then becomes a great impulse toward Christianity, and leads directly to spiritual science. I may perhaps best make clear to you the things that really concern human evolution if I remind you of some of the things connected with the mysteries in pre-Christian times. On other occasions, I have indicated what was attempted in these mysteries, and refer to them in my book titled Christianity as Mystical Fact, where I quote what Plato says about them. It is true that we can today refer with a smile of understanding to such sayings of his as, quote, "Those who are initiated into the mysteries participate in eternal life. Others are as if cut off," close quote, incomplete, in parentheses. In this book, I drew attention to the words of Plato with purpose, for they show in all seriousness what he had to say of the mysteries. The great secret of the mysteries consisted in this: that by a special human endeavor, the pupil was enabled, in pre-Christian times, to have insight into what would have become of the mineral and animal kingdoms if they had evolved along the direct line with all the dispositions originally implanted in them. A knowledge, therefore, arose, which made it possible for these men to say, if the mineral and animal kingdoms had evolved fully the aptitudes laid down in them, it would have been possible for man to reveal his true countenance in the spheres in which he then dwelt. The pupils of the mysteries became completely transformed when they had received instruction in the inner secrets of nature, and had been permitted to behold man as he really had been originally. They then realized that conditions found at present in the kingdom of warm-blooded animals, in woody or bark-bearing trees, and in the kingdom of man, do not reveal their origin. They remain unexplained, for they do not bear within them the impress of their origins. Thus, while plants and minerals do not fulfill the aim of their existence, men and animals do not disclose their origins. In pre-Christian times, it was very necessary that certain men should be initiated, and herein we perceive the true mission of the mysteries. In earliest times, knowledge was atavistic. It was only later, when this atavistic knowledge withdrew, that it became necessary for certain individuals to receive initiation into the secrets of nature, that is, of the animal and vegetable kingdoms, so that man should be known as he truly is. It is equally important in our day to refer again and again to man's origin, to teach him about himself from the other side, so that he may once more reveal his origin, once more feel himself to be a part of all existence. This I have attempted to do, falteringly, in title Occult Science, or title An Outline of Occult Science, so far as is possible in our day. What the mysteries did for pre-Christian times, spiritual science does for the days since the mystery of Golgotha. It is only when we realize how this act has really divided history in two parts that we gradually rise to a point where a true observation of it can be made. The mystery teachers and guides of olden times knew well why training was necessary for those seeking initiation, and why, up to a certain date, it was strictly insisted on that only those who had gone through this training could be initiated. This was especially the case in ancient Greece. The object of this training was that the secrets to be imparted should be received into the man's life in the right way. It was considered just as impossible to impart the secrets of the mysteries to those who were not worthy of them, as it was for Jesus Christ to communicate to the scribes and Pharisees the mysteries of the kingdom of God. He could only do this to those who were his pupils. No blame can be ascribed to the leaders of the mysteries that, about the time when the mystery of Golgotha was drawing nigh, these were no longer what they had been. It was not their fault that they had come to an end. It was Imperial Rome which most unjustifiably dragged forth the mysteries from the sphere of secrecy. A time came when the leaders could no longer withstand the commands of the Caesars. The fact that spiritual life was violated by the Roman emperors is clearly reflected in every event of that time. A man like the Baptist saw the approach of this in every particular, for those who have the will to see can see what is approaching. What such men see, they express in words which, though often ambiguous, are true in every respect. The words of the Baptist, quote, "Change your hearts, the kingdom of heaven is at hand," close quote, might be rendered as follows, quote, "Behold, that which was contained in the ancient mysteries and which brought salvation to mankind is here no longer. It has been seized forcibly by Imperial Rome, which has spread its pinions also over the spirit of the Jewish people you see around you. Change your thoughts, therefore. Seek salvation no longer in what comes from Rome, but seek it in the things that are not of this earth. Receive baptism, whereby your etheric bodies are loosened, so that you may see that which is now approaching, and which will bring new mysteries, for the old mysteries have been reft from you by force." What had been done was done first by Augustus, though he made no wrong use of it. The emperors of Rome, simply by the power of their imperial commands, demanded to be initiated into the mysteries. This became their general practice, and it was this above all which John the Baptist wished to have changed. His object was to set those who desired baptism apart from the ordinary course of human existence, so that they should see the well-being of man only in that which proceeded from Rome. So that they should not see the well-being of mankind only in that which proceeded from Rome. The emperors who were most thoroughly initiated into the secrets of the mysteries were Caligula and the later Nero. The fact that such men could extract the hidden knowledge of the mysteries by force is something belonging to the secrets of historical evolution. Only think what the attitude of soul must have been of those who knew that this was coming and who knew what it all meant. Try to enter into the thoughts and feelings of men like John the Baptist. It would have been very natural for such men to say, "That which must come and will come is the kingdom of heaven. It is there that the holy mysteries must henceforth be sought, and not in the kingdom of men. History often speaks through its allegories. While Diogenes was still in Greece, he once went round the Athenian marketplace with a lantern looking for, quote, the men, close quote, who were lost, those whose power to see was lost. Why were they lost? Not because they were unknown, but because the time was approaching when they would see no longer that which it was possible to communicate to them of the secrets of evolution. The fundamental facts relating to this were known to men like Caligula and Nero, and just because of this they were veiled in darkness. Diogenes, in his way, and also John the Baptist, in his, felt the time approaching when, because the secrets of the mysteries had been divulged, men would be plunged into darkness and would have to be sought for with lanterns. Caligula had been instructed in the rudiments of the ancient wisdom of the mysteries, so that he might live truly within spiritual conditions. He knew, therefore, how to control his consciousness between waking and falling asleep, so that he could hold intercourse with those beings known to the ancient mysteries as the moon gods. It appertained to that hidden knowledge to know what lay behind ordinary day consciousness, to know how this became changed when a man was able to penetrate to other states of consciousness. For through the fact that man is aware where his individuality is when it withdraws during sleep into the spiritual world, he is also aware that his individuality is not only incarnated here as a being of nature related to other natural beings, but that it is related to the spiritual world, to all that lives within the spiritual hierarchies. When a man knows the secrets of the moon gods, his relationship to the sun gods naturally changes also. These, owing to the restriction of his vision through Lucifer, he does not behold in the surrounding world with his daytime vision, but he can behold them at night with his awakened clairvoyant consciousness. A man like Caligula knows by his own experience that from the time he falls asleep until he awakes, his individuality is in the spiritual world, and further that during daytime consciousness, this individuality does not live and move merely within the coverings of external nature, but is under the influence of the spirits of the sun. I do not mean the physical sun, but of the spirits appertaining to the life of the sun. Caligula had not, of course, undergone the training that was necessary for all this. He could, during sleep, hold intercourse with the moon gods, and this was why he sometimes addressed Jupiter in daily life as, quote, Brother Jupiter, close quote. He frequently used this form of address, for quite naturally he felt he was a dweller in the spiritual world to which Jupiter belonged, and he sought by his actions to demonstrate that he belonged to the spiritual world. Sometimes he appeared as Bacchus, with the thyrsus in his hand and wreathed with oak leaves. At other times he appeared as Hercules, with club and lion's skin, and had himself reverenced as Hercules. At other times he appeared as Apollo, carrying a bow, his head crowned with golden rays and surrounded by choirs, singing the customary songs in his honor. He also appeared sometimes as the god Mercury and as Jupiter. On one occasion, a poet who was considered to have knowledge of such matters was commanded to decide which was the greater, Caligula or Jupiter, and a statue of Jupiter was placed beside Caligula for this purpose. The poet was scourged because he did not decide that Caligula was the greater. What can be gathered from this judgment? It is instructive to associate with it the words uttered by Lucifer at the temptation in the wilderness. Quote, your eyes, senses, shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, close quote. To which may be added, quote, you shall distinguish good and evil, close quote. The power to distinguish good and evil was, however, implanted in man by a spirit who could only live in evolution up to a certain time. This time had now expired. It came to an end when John the Baptist first appeared with his cry, quote, "The kingdom of heaven is at hand," close quote. He did not, however, add the further words, quote, "and the kingdom of Lucifer is at an end," close quote. It was natural that he should only speak of the kingdom of heaven. In many of the judgments of Caligula, it was easily seen that the power to distinguish right from wrong no longer existed. Only when a judicial error had been made, and owing to the confusion between guilt and innocence, an innocent man had been condemned to death, Caligula said, quote, "It matters not, for the innocent man was as guilty as the others," close quote. And when Petronius lay under sentence of death, he said, quote, "Those who have condemned him might just as well be condemned themselves, for they are equally guilty," close quote. From this you can see that the power to distinguish good from evil had not continued into the time of which we are speaking. Nero was a similar type of initiate to Caligula. At bottom he was a psychoanalyst, but on a grand scale, for he condemned the saying that everything that arose in man was the result of the way in which sex affected him, a teaching that commonplace psychoanalysts have accepted in our day. Professor Freud is not Nero, however, by any means, not that he is devoid of soul, but of all greatness of soul. What John the Baptist knew was known also to Nero. Nero knew, and herein lies the difference between him and Caligula. Nero knew, because of his initiation into the mysteries, that there was a close connection between the present state of the mysteries and that of man. He knew that the true impulse of the contents of the mysteries had to a great extent become uncertain, that they were losing power. It was not John the Baptist alone who said that the old world order was come to an end, though it was he who added the further words, quote, "Change your thoughts, the kingdom of heaven is at hand," close quote. Nero knew also that the kingdom of the old had come to an end, that a vast break had occurred in evolution. Added to this knowledge, he had his demoniac consciousness. He had his demoniac consciousness. All the devilish things belonging to an unworthy initiate are to be found in him. He could foresee the destruction of the world, just as the Baptist did, just as Jesus Christ did. When the things that Jesus Christ and John said about the destruction of the world are rightly understood, men will see the futility of the ordinary acceptance of these sayings, which seek to assign a definite time to it, and they will understand the sense in which the Bible speaks of the coming destruction of the world. Nero knew that a new order was coming, and it did not please him. How characteristic is his saying that he would like nothing better than to take part in the destruction of the world. Quote, "It would delight me," close quote, he said, quote, "to see the world go up in flames," close quote. This desire to see the world go up in flames was a special delusion of his, and from it sprang the act, which may be doubted historically, but which all the same is true, that he caused Rome to be set on fire, because in his delusion he pictured the conflagration spreading so far that the whole world would be consumed. These are a few typical examples, showing how the world was then in a certain way coming to an end, and how it would have to begin anew. In actual life, however, the course of events shows that one condition passes gradually into the other, and that old conditions often endure after the first impulse to the new has already been felt. Although since the mystery of Golgotha, the kingdom of heaven was among men, the empire of Rome continued in declining evolution alongside of it. The empire continued in decadent form, and is the cause that at the present day the most divergent views as to what is right and wrong are expressed even among people of learning. It continues even among us today and permeates growing Christianity with the spirit of imperial Rome. Were we to investigate further along these lines, some very remarkable facts would come to light. In the first place, we would find that all the ideas of law and justice which arose later, point back to the justice of Rome, that the Roman sense of rights, which, according to Christ, are anti-Christian, have permeated everything. Many things would have to be mentioned if we were to review all the instances in which Roman imperialism endures to this day. There is something instinctive in the way Roman history is taught in the schools, and also in the way those historians who write the pleasing fables they designate history today convey to mankind the consciousness of imperial Rome, so that the spirit which ruled it is entirely left out. This spirit is omitted, even by the most learned. One thing has most certainly resulted to the fact that the full significance of the moment when the cross was raised on Golgotha has not been brought home to the consciousness of humanity as a whole, which is that the real meaning of that great event has been passed by. The outcome is that, if we desire light and not darkness, we must search everything in modern life that is connected with a true understanding of Christianity, so that we may gradually develop that divine anger which was frequently felt by Christ himself when he had to reply to questions by the scribes and Pharisees. I have attempted in this lecture to give you a picture of the conditions existing in the centuries into which Christianity broke, and have laid stress on the need to study history much more profoundly than is customary, especially that part of it in which the mystery of Golgotha occurred. We must acquire a feeling for the value of things, and try to distinguish those that are important from those that are not. The end of Lecture 5.